Okay, good morning. And we're going to continue our study in church history today. We have already begun the subject of Crusades and Reconquista, though we haven't finished it. We said last week that popes preached Crusades, and we're talking from the very end of the 11th century on into the 13th century now. That's the time frame. Popes preach crusades in order to reopen pilgrimage routes, prop up Byzantium, stop infighting, and glorify Christ. Just to remind you, the Middle East had largely been conquered in recent decades by the Seljuk Turks, and those, unlike some prior additions of Muslim governments or caliphates, had been hostile to Christians robbing and killing people and cutting off access to pilgrimage sites. And you have to remember how important pilgrimage was in the Middle Ages to people's spiritual self-conception. But also propping up Byzantium, remember that's the old remnant of the Eastern Roman Empire that still exists. Even though East and Western churches are largely estranged, the West is still looking for chances, to heal that split. And one of those presents itself when in the 1070s, most of what's left of the Asian side of Byzantium gets taken over by the Turks. Let me just recap here briefly by way of markers. There they are. Okay, remember, originally Byzantium, or Eastern Roman Empire, would have been, pretty much the eastern half of what had been Rome, right? Okay, so like in the 500s, in the days of Justinian, when the West has collapsed, fallen victim to barbarian invasions, Byzantium actually expanded for a while, right? And they had chunks of Italy, as well as bits of Spain, expanded into North Africa. But now that we're into the early second millennium, Byzantium basically is just Greece and the Balkans, plus what you would call Turkey. And some of Syria. Okay, that's what's left of Byzantium at this stage. And then, in the 1070s to 1090s, the Turks are not only coming in from what we would call India to take over these portions of the Middle East, including the Holy Land, of course, but also they're going to take over the majority of what we would call Turkey, which is a decent chunk of what's left of Byzantium. So now, you've got the emperor over here. Like him? Saying, help! And that's the Pope's cue to rally the troops, literally. But the Pope, remember, has other goals as well. He wants to stop infighting amongst these kingdoms and lesser principalities in Western Christianity, to stop infighting, and also to glorify Christ. They honestly believed that they were serving the interests of the Lord, and they didn't see it, of course, as a war of conquest. They thought that they were taking back what the Muslims took from them in terms of possession of the Holy Land and access to its pilgrimage sites. Now, the Crusaders themselves, both the kings and princes and the knights and the lesser people who fought, there are a variety of reasons. This isn't a simple thing. There is, of course, the desire for land in a feudalistic age. The opportunity to go take away somebody's territory is very appealing because territory is the basis of your power and wealth. But also people would fight for freedom. It's kind of a fresh start kind of deal. If you're if you've got the short end of the stick in terms of your family inheritance, or if you've got, crimes in your past and a cloud hanging over you, a way to go start a new life and to do it in a way that everybody will agree is virtuous is to take the cross, as the Crusaders would say, that is, pledge themselves to go on crusade and go to the far end of the known world and fight for the Lord. And so there's religious ones in addition. Absolution, remember the popes are promising instant forgiveness to people who die in the Crusades. And there's devotion, people genuinely thought they were serving Jesus. And pilgrimage, not only to reopen pilgrimage routes, but the Crusaders would sometimes even describe themselves as pilgrims. The idea of going to the Holy Land as a pilgrim to pilgrimage sites and going to the Holy Land as a warrior to take those pilgrimage sites is very much conflated. And you'll see that even in the military monastic orders report that we hope to get to at the end of today. The First Crusade was called by Pope Urban II. I gave you his speech that he delivered at Clermont in France last week, which is really fascinating. I always find not just for what it says, but for kind of the worldview you can pick up from people who, you know, give you famous speeches like that. And that First Crusade was really the only successful one. It established several short-lived Latin kingdoms. Now remember, the Byzantine Empire wanted help getting back Turkey, but he's also thinking, hey, if they come conquer the Holy Land, we can attach that back to the Byzantine Empire too, right? Well, when you get the kings of France, Burgundy, Holy Roman Empire, whatever, going over to the Middle East and expending all that treasure and blood to gain those kingdoms, they don't feel like handing them over to Byzantium. They will establish instead a series of Latin, Western kingdoms here. And that actually will contribute to tensions between Eastern and Western Christianity, whereas the Crusades, in part, were supposed to help resolve them. So there's a few short-lived Latin kingdoms. Over the next couple hundred years, they will gradually disintegrate. There will be, you know, they'll lose Jerusalem, then they'll negotiate to get it back. There will be multiple battles, multiple Crusades. Later Crusades are going to be less successful. We said the disastrous fourth one actually turned into a war against Constantinople itself. And there's a whole sordid history behind that, but it turns into, you know, it's the Pope trying to direct his own personal crusade, and the tens of thousands of people that he gets going end up attacking first their fellow Catholics. They all, you know, the Pope excommunicates the entire army. Now they're this armed mob. Now they're under the leadership of, you know, Venetian mercenaries. Now they're looking for plunder and a paycheck. And anyway, the whole thing is just the bottom of the episode, really. And finalizes the split between East and West. And actually, the Byzantine Empire momentarily collapses into certain factions and chaos. Thankfully for them, they get themselves back together, and the Byzantine Empire will last a few hundred more years, but in a much reduced and weakened state, and it will ultimately fall and vanish into history in the 1400s. Now, assessing the Crusades, I hope it's reasonably obvious that Crusades are bad. I know there is a strain of thought that wants to glorify these and, you know, make picture books out of them and teach our children to talk and think as if they're crusaders of one kind or another. But the basic concept of, you know, waging a bloody war of conquest against earthly kingdoms in order to supposedly do God's work in this way is drastically misplaced. And it is rightly considered a stain on the history of Christianity. And, you know, people, as you know, are still mad about it, or at least they claim to be, which is legitimate to a certain extent. In terms of assessing the Crusades, let me first of all make sure we understand how this could happen, because I was asked about that last week. How do you get to this mindset where you're waging these kinds of wars in Jesus' name? Because we cringe to think of that, and we're horrified by modern manifestations of that, either among so-called Christians who do terrorist things or amongst Muslims who do similar things in the name of Islam. How do you get to that? But also in terms of assessing, just let me be clear. While this is certainly misguided and certainly not recommended, it's not as if this is unprovoked, unilateral villainy. This grows out of the context of long-standing conflict, and that's part of actually how you get there, the how do we get the Crusades question. Christianity had seen its relationship to Islam as a military one ever since Islam started spreading in the mid-600s and on into the mid-700s. Islam was initially a religion of conquest that swept through North Africa, that went up into Spain, that had to be rebuffed finally by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours. Europe was in fear for its life. And so the relationship between Islam and Christianity was always framed in military and political terms, not in terms of evangelizing lost souls. It was those are the people who, you know, want to wipe us out or subjugate and enslave us, at least. Also, keep in mind that in the 11th century, our time frame here, you also have centuries of precedent for church-state entanglement. You have the church seeing itself as part of the feudalistic structure of Western Europe. The church itself is a massive tax-generating landholder. The so-called Papal States, the great kingdom of central Italy, right, is plugged into this feudalistic system, and you've got this back-and-forth relationship with the empire. And, of course, by this time, the resurgent papacy in the days of those Cluniac popes, where the two swords, the spiritual and the civil sword, you know, the popes are more or less taking the emperor and say, let me show you how to use that. And if you don't use your power the way I want you to use it, I'll strip you of your power. I crowned you and I can uncrown you. In that kind of context where the popes have come to see themselves not only as a political player in their own right, but also as the spiritual puppet master of the existing political powers, you know, it's not a big step to say, hey, it's time for a war, right? So the way the papacy conceived of itself, the way the church was operating within Western society, and of course the papacy also sees itself as the steward of Western culture, responsible to stop infighting and so forth. So you have sort of existing Muslim antagonism. You had a very real historic threat as well as very real provocation in what was happening to Eastern Christianity in the days of the Seljuk Turk conquests. And also we tend not to appreciate the value of pilgrimage to the Middle Ages Christians. You know, you and I maybe go on retreats. You and I maybe will go on some kind of a pilgrimage or something. You want to go to some holy, you know, even now that kind of thing holds a sort of mystical appeal sometimes to us. It can be a formative experience to go on some kind of a trip. But, you know, this is more than sightseeing and more than going on a trip. This is proving that you're for real. Keep in mind, in the Middle Ages, you see things in Christianity that we totally disagree with, but you should understand where they're coming from. Like monasticism. I mean, what a horrible idea to impose on yourself unrealistic, unbiblical vows. But we said that it's coming from a place of being willing to suffer for Christ. And once the age of martyrdom is over, how does that look? And I want to give myself up as a living sacrifice to God. And what a misguided effort to do that, right? But I think you can recognize where it's coming from. Same thing with pilgrimage, and same thing with crusading. You know, there's lots of calls to military action in the Scripture, and I don't just mean the Old Testament, which was sometimes misapplied back then as it is today. I mean this idea of Christ is the king, his kingdom is growing, the gates of hell will not stand against it, and you and I are called to be warriors and to fight the good fight. Now that is a spiritual call, and the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, the New Testament says. So I'm not defending crusading, I'm just saying you can see how it comes from this. Christ is not being honored enough. I need to be fighting. I need to be working. I need to be doing something. It's coming from a place that maybe you can recognize. And if you were in this situation culturally, politically, historically, you can see maybe how that feeling of devotion would take this misguided path. All right, so there's a lot of contributing factors here, but yeah. Also something to be aware of, the conduct of the Crusades, you know, is often vilified as well, but it's not like these wars were unprecedented or unprovoked, and a lot of people will look at how the different armies conducted themselves. It's not like you had one side going in and abusing and steamrolling some innocent people. Okay, this is a mess. It's a complicated mess that we're skimming over quickly. I'm just warning you against the sort of two-dimensional view of the Crusades that easily turns them into a catchword with everything that's wrong with Christianity and everything that legitimizes every Muslim grievance and, you know, portrays every act of any Western government or person as some kind of revival of the Crusades. It's a lot of hay gets made out of these Crusades. They're a very specific event that grows at a very specific set of circumstances at a very specific point in time. All right, some consequences of the Crusades. What's going to happen once you get into the 12 and 1300s? Well, European wealth, trade, and cultural developments are going to accelerate. In fact, the Italian Renaissance, which gets going about 100 years before the Northern European Renaissance that you might be more familiar with, the Italian Renaissance is going to grow in part out of the fact that these crusading armies are funneled through Italy. The funding is, you know, funneled through Italy. The transportation, especially Venetian transportation, this is all funneled through Italy. And people who come back with their plunder or come back with their new, you know, intellectual knowledge or come back with their new appreciation for certain kinds of artwork that they've never seen before. They're going to come back through Italy. And so because you get now an increased contact with the East, not only Eastern Christianity, Byzantine Christianity, but also increased contact with the Arabs, and with their trade network that will extend out into India and even China, you get this greater interest in continuing commerce and building of trade routes. And this will get you, you know, into the age of Marco Polo and the spice trade and stuff like that. So you get these seeds ultimately of Italian Renaissance and ultimately of an entire European revival after some very dark days in the 14th century that we'll get to. Also, intellectually, you get a revival of Aristotle in the West. Western thinkers will come into contact again with Greeks who have kept alive Greek scholarship all this time over there in the somewhat isolated East. But also there have been Muslim scholars, some in Spain, but also in the Middle East, who have developed Aristotle in their own way. And a couple of them are going to be influential on guys like Thomas Aquinas. So you get this accelerated exchange not only of goods but also of ideas that grows out of the Crusades. Also an accelerated exchange of disease. Maybe we'll talk about that some other time. But also you get the finalization of the Great Schism and the hastened demise of Byzantium we already talked about, and Muslim antagonism toward Christian Europe. Not that it was lacking before this, but this certainly creates hatred, grudges, suspicion for centuries to come. And doesn't make any easier the prospect of evangelizing Muslims, not that there were really more than a couple guys we know of that even tried it in the Middle Ages. Okay, I need to move on here because I want to get to the military monastic orders here, but I need to say something about the Reconquista. This reconquest, if your Spanish is really sharp, you'll catch that. This reconquest of Iberia, the peninsula that is today Spain and Portugal, it spans 8 centuries. It starts from the Muslim conquest of the Visigoths. Remember, the Visigoths are that tribe of Germans who took over a big chunk of the Western Empire when the Western Empire collapsed in the 400s. The Visigoths were Arians, right? They didn't believe in the deity of Jesus. So they were sort of this sub-Christian barbarian kingdom, and they set up their rule of Spain for a couple hundred years. But then, into the late 600s, early 700s, you get the incursions of the armies of the Caliphate into, I'm pointing at an overhead without turning on the overhead, into Spain. Need a new color here. Green, we're using that one for Muslims. Okay. So basically, by the end of the 700s, except for sort of the northern mountains and the Pyrenees, all of this is going to be under Muslim control. We forget a large chunk of Europe was Muslim for a really long time. And remember, there had been in the 700s incursions both to coastal France and up towards Tours, where Muslims would have expanded even further if they could, but were stopped by the Franks. So now the question is, how are you going to get this peninsula back, Iberia? How are you going to reconquer it for the Christian kingdoms, which have either been wiped out or are clinging to dear life up there in the mountains? And what will happen is, from the 700s, the Reconquista actually begins before the Iberia is fully lost. For the next 800 years, you're going to have these kingdoms push their way southward. And as you can imagine, any war that spans hundreds and hundreds of years on again and off again, there's going to be way more back and forths and alliances, and sometimes Christians will ally with Muslims against other Christians, and I'm drastically simplifying this. But there's an 800-year process by which these kingdoms essentially expand southward, and by the 1400s, the Iberian Peninsula will be fully recovered for Christian kingdoms. They're actually not fully fused yet. You know, you've got Castile and Aragon. You've got the Portuguese, which are their own thing. They're not fully fused yet, but something interesting arises from that. Say the kingdoms of Castile, Leon, and Aragon expand southward. Wars attract would-be crusaders, which is how this fits in. Same time frame, same tactics. You're going to have military monastics involved in fighting the Muslims. You're going to have some of the same calls and appeals, you know, to vindicate Christ by fighting the infidels. A lot of that's going to be going on in Spain at the same time it's going on over here on this end of the Mediterranean. But some consequences from this Reconquista, this 800-year-long back-and-forth, messy attempt to reconquer Spain for Christianity. The Spain that emerges in 1492, that's the date when the last of the Muslims are defeated, and Spain is ready to turn its attention elsewhere, as you probably know. What emerges in 1492 is a kind of empire and culture in Spain that is zealous like no other, militarized like no other. This is going to have huge consequences not only for, you know, the Spanish takeover of, oh, I don't know, the rest of the world, not only in terms of Spanish armies going with the Habsburg rulers into the rest of Europe, but of course taking over the New World. It's going to have an impact on the church, on the story of Christianity. You're going to get the Spanish Inquisition. It starts in the 1400s. That's basically that king and queen-sponsored witch hunt into any so-called heretic or alleged Jew in Spanish territories, and you'll be tortured until you confess kind of thing. That'll go on for a few hundred years. You're going to get conquistadors. You're going to get the Inquisition. You're going to find that in the time of the Reformation in the following century, you know, the Reformation will never get a toehold in Spain. The Spanish are radicalized, militarized, and they're fanatical. That explains a lot of Spanish behavior in the time of the Reformation that we'll get to. You're not going to want to be a Protestant like in the Netherlands, where you have a Spanish overlord imposing the Spanish Inquisition. That's really bad news. You're not going to want to be an Englishman whose queen is a Spaniard and who takes as her husband a Spaniard. That is not good news for you. And in fact, left to her own devices, she'll become known as Bloody Mary, the, you know, the Spanish offspring of a Spanish queen. Anyway, I think you know a lot about that story already, and we'll get to it later. I just want to be clear that there is a whole other sort of crusading culture going on over there as part of this story. Okay, do you have any brief questions as we transition now to this report on the military monastic orders about crusades and Reconquista, keeping in mind that we are being very surface skimmy? Sorry about that. Okay, why don't we turn it over to who's doing this report? Joseph is. Excellent. Let's welcome Joseph to teach us about this, please.
Feels really weird. Okay, so the monastic orders that were military started a little bit after the First Crusade. And they were essentially just monks that were fighting for land that they believed was their land, like you said before. They were not only dedicated to God, like most monks were at that time, but they were also dedicated to the defense of the Holy Land and the people who live there. And the three ones that I'm going to be talking about are the Templars, the Hospitallers, and the Teutonic Knights. So the first military order was the Templars, and it happened, they came about after the First Crusade, which was about 1095 to 99. And the papacy decided that the city of Jerusalem, which they had just captured, needed to be protected, and a holy place should probably be protected by holy men. So it was founded as a military order around 1120, and while the monks did their normal duties, they also trained for battle. And later on, more manpower was needed for the Crusades, and just about anyone could get in, including criminals. And criminals could get in on the pretense of dying on the battlefield and earning an instant trip to heaven, exempt of all sins. But he would still have to take the regular vows that came with monkhood. Once that happened, the monk could train to become a soldier, which was called a sergeant, or a servant, which literally served the knights, and they could eventually become knights. However, men who were already knights or came from noble blood could join as ordained knights from the beginning, and this lasted for pretty much the end of the Templar Order. So it was put in place to protect travelers to Jerusalem, protect the city itself, and fight the Islams and Turks, pretty much just the Muslims. And they had a special dress code, which I need to learn how to put this on. So, on? Not on. There we go. So is that? No, that's upside down. There we go. So as you can see, they mainly dressed in white, and they wore a red cross. Now this depiction is a little bit later in their history. They originally had a red cross right here over the heart, but here they have it right over the chest. And you saw in the picture they wore beards. That was what monks wore, what they were known for. They also wore their hair about down to here. And for their armor, now most knights had like full suits of armor of metal, but the Templars usually had chainmail, which was pretty expensive, but they were able to afford it, as we'll see later on. So it grew its wealth from conquest after taking over and fighting Muslim cities. And so if another reason that they got so wealthy was because they pretty much operated as a bank for people who were going to Jerusalem and all the other places in the Middle East. So if a traveler was going to Jerusalem, they would deposit their money with the Templars, and the Templars would take it to Jerusalem. When the owner came to retrieve his money, he would also have to give a small interest, and this was where they got most of their money. This and the looting of Muslim strongholds during the Second to Future Crusades for the duration of the Templars' existence was enough to boost the Templars' wealth. However, as the Crusades came and went, the Templars were losing ground, and eventually Jerusalem was taken back. Now, we'll rewind a little bit to 1113, I think it was. Another religious order, which was not militaristic at the first, in the first place, is called the Knights Hospitallers, and they were originally put together by a monk named Gerard under the Augustinian rule, and it was a rule that would govern them. Was this a hospital rule, the Augustinian rule. I'm really, really unclear about this part. But they were a hospital. That's what they did. They would take in weak and ill who were either on the... They would set up monasteries on the road to Jerusalem, and that was their function for their first few years. But Gerard's successor, Raymond de Puy, I don't know what language that is. It's probably French, and I can't pronounce it. But he inserted the Benedictine rule and made the hospitallers military because of the Crusades. That was very important at the time. And they were made military around the same time that the Templars came about, so there was quite a bit of tension between those two orders. So, the vows of the hospitallers followed the same blueprint because they were military. They took on a similar shape, except for the involvement of the hospital installation, of course. Now we're going to look at the way that they were dressed. And this is quite radically different. So as you can see, they wear black capes and robes with a white cross on the shield. You can probably see it a little better. A few more depictions of their clothes was red with a white cross, and I believe that's historically accurate, but this is probably the most common. So, moving on, they probably held the most strongholds during the Crusades, and they fought continuously against the Muslims even after the Crusades were starting to dwindle away. Their largest castle was located near the city of Acre, or in the city of Acre in Israel, but they lost that when Jerusalem was captured by the Muslims, probably near the end of the Crusades. Their newest and probably their strongest yet was their stronghold at Rhodes, which was also being relentlessly attacked by the Muslims long after the Crusades, and even after the Templars were no longer existent. They lost their stronghold in Rhodes to a Muslim conqueror, I believe it was one of the Turks, Solyman II, and allowed them to return home, even providing them with ships and supplies, which is pretty nice of him. And when they got back home, they requested from Charles V of Spain the island of Malta, which was a pretty small island, but it was a pretty good stronghold. He granted that to them finally in 1530, and they immediately began raiding Turkish ships. So Solyman was not very happy about that, and nearly wiped the army out. Fortunately for that order, the Spanish came and scattered Solyman's army. But even all this individual plundering of Muslim ports and cities was not enough to gain them the excess wealth the Templars had, because they weren't a bank like the Templars. Now, around 1190, in Acre, there was another military order called the Teutonic Knights, and they were pretty much the same as the Hospitallers. They began as a hospitalling order and then transitioned into a military order during the Crusades. And during the Fourth Crusade, they occupied the city of Jerusalem. Now, I believe in the Fourth Crusade, Jerusalem was under Crusader control. But they had to leave when the Turks took the city back, of course. Now we'll look at their dress. And this is kind of familiar from the hospitallers, instead of black robes, they had white robes, and instead of a white cross, they had a black cross. But that was pretty much the way that they looked for their whole existence, and we'll talk about them later, but the dress has not changed since. So, they fought, not in the Middle East, but they fought on the German front for, against the Prussians. At some point in their history, they were appealed to by a Polish duke who asked them to defend his borders against the, rogue Prussians. And on doing so, the order gained much land in Germany and the northern European area, and they sort of made their own little country because of that land. So, as time went by, decades of fighting in the Middle East, the Crusaders lost steam and will. Reasons for fighting were so unclear, and the means were really chaotic and destructive. So the Crusades were just slowly left behind. Except for in Spain, of course. But despite all this, there were still military orders. So that had to be dealt with. The Hospitallers, long after the Crusades, were still fighting Middle Eastern forces. The Knights Temple, the Knights of the Temple, or the Knights Templar, became richer. And the French Prince Philip was growing increasingly tired of their effects on his ruling and their wealth. So on Friday the 13th in 1312, he had the Templars excommunicated and began burning and martyring the leaders and a handful of others who were involved with the Templars, and their order ended. And all of their wealth was given to the Hospitallers. The Teutonics, however, lasted untouched in the area of Germany and Prussia. And until Napoleon Bonaparte conquered Holland, all that northern European area, and disbanded the order. But fortunately for them, it was reestablished in 1815 by King William of Orange. The Hospitallers today are serving as the sovereign military order of Malta, so they're still around. And the Teutonics are also still around. They were the Prussian duchy, however you pronounce that. And they now operate under the Catholic Church as a knightly order. So all these orders were put in place to defend the Holy Land and its people, and the lake locations in the Middle East, but not all of them lasted. So, just goes to show you. What is it going to show you? I'm trying to think of a way to wrap this up. The reasons for fighting Muslims and killing people sort of loses interest when, as time goes by. And it got a little useless after a while, even though they still cared about these places and found them very important. That's all I got for today. Thank you for listening.
Anyone have a question for Joseph?
Well, that's good. I did my job.